Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. In March, we marked the 10th year anniversary of the start of the war in Iraq. The U.S. is now officially out of that country, and President Obama has promised we will be out of Afghanistan by 2014. But the tolls these wars have taken are wide and deep. Tens of thousands of Iraqis killed, 4,500 Americans dead, 32,000 Americans wounded in service over the last 10 years, and tens or hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghanis wounded and terrorized. And even after wars are officially over, the effects of them come home to roost. One of today's guests, journalist Aaron Glantz, writes about that in his 2009 book, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. There are now a total of 2.4 million veterans from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan alone. And nearly 1 million veterans are currently waiting for their benefit claims to be processed. 600,000 of those are considered backlogged, meaning that they have waited more than 4 months since submitting their claims. The average wait time is 273 days. But another of today's guests, veteran Dave Smith, had to wait 414 days while suffering from PTSD, depression, and insomnia. His close friend was also waiting, but committed suicide a week before his claim was approved. Aaron Glantz says 97% of these claims are in paper form, just sitting in giant stacks in the VA offices. So why don't we have a better system, and what is happening to veterans in the meantime? I'm joined in studio by Aaron Glantz, who covers veterans and domestic military issues for the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's spent more than 10 years covering the Iraq War and the treatment of veterans receive when they come home. He's the author of 3 books on the war, and the most recent one is The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. Hi, Aaron.
It's good to be here.
And we'll be joined shortly by Dave Smith, who's a veteran of the Iraq War. He served from 2003 to 2007. He's now a student at UC Berkeley, and he will be graduating this week with a degree in political science. So we'll look forward to hearing from Dave. In the meantime, Aaron, I wonder if you could just give us a sense of what it is actually like for returning vets to come back into civilian society. What kind of orientation do they get from the military about the transition and about how to access VA services and the GI Bill? What is that like?
Well, I think that the most profound change that you get when you get out of the military and you come home from Iraq or Afghanistan is that you have been through an awesome experience. You know, you have seen people killed, perhaps you have killed people yourself, perhaps some of your friends have been killed. And you come back to a place like San Francisco or Oakland or San Jose, and nobody is talking about, nobody is thinking about that. People are interested in the latest iPhone. People are worried about the economy. And you are still trying to get sorted out this tremendous experience that you've been through, and all of the people that you were with when you were in the military, who you were your buddies, who you shared that with, has scattered all over the country. And so you find yourself frequently very alone. And then on top of that, you have some of the political issues that you were mentioning in your introduction, the difficulty getting your benefits, the difficulty getting treatment for injuries and illnesses that you may have sustained because of the war. And I'd say that those two things together, the difficulty assimilating into a society which is not engaged with the war that you just fought on their behalf. And then
does that surprise a lot of the vets that are coming home, or do they expect that?
Well, I don't know if it surprises people on an intellectual level, but it definitely is extremely shocking on a visceral level. And a lot of this stuff is not happening in that intellectual part of the brain. It's happening on the gut level. You know, you experienced the death of your friend on a gut level. You saw the fires and the explosions the firefights in the war on a gut level, not on intellectual level. And a certain degree, you know, a lot of the difficulties that people have coming home are assimilating what they kind of know to be reasonable on an intellectual level. You know, that people should be concerned about their mortgage and their house, and like this is all good, right, with, you know, how they feel on the gut level, which is that the country is completely out to lunch and sent them to war, we're not even interested in it. You know, we're not interested in Afghanistan right now.
So it sounds like
if you've just come back from Afghanistan, it's like a complete disaster for you in terms of, you know, your friends. You know, what do you have to talk about? So there is that sense of isolation that you're just mentioning.
And what kind of preparation does the military give you as a veteran to this? I mean, is there kind of a crash course in reintegration?
They have, you know, they have a crash course when you get out. But, you know, think about boot camp when you go in. It's not like one day or 2 days. It's a significant amount of time and investment that the military puts into you to prepare you to go fight in a war. And then when you get out, you get kind of a crash course, a few days about your benefits. This is what's available, blah, blah, blah. Most guys are just like they want to check out. Most guys, you know, they do tell you, oh, these are some things that you might want to you know, say you have problems with so we can help you. But, you know, a lot of folks know that if they speak up in that moment that the military might keep them for longer to deal with those issues. And the last thing they want to do in that moment is be in the military. They might want to get back to their family and get on with their lives, you know, after being through the war. And so it's not really the optimal time to be doing outreach on these things.
So we're going to talk a lot about the VA system. I was wondering if you could just give us a little crash course in what is the VA system? How does it work?
So the crash course in the VA system is that there's basically two things that we promise veterans who serve our country in war. We promise them health care. So if you get hurt in the war, we will take care of you by providing you quality health care. And we promise them compensation. We promise them that if you get hurt in the war and you can't work, or you can't work up to the level that you would have been able to if you didn't go to war, that we will give you a monthly benefits check to cover the difference. And those are the two things that we have promised. And so the VA has a healthcare bureaucracy, the hospital system to serve the healthcare needs, and it has a benefits bureaucracy to help people get their benefits.
So how did we get to this huge backlog? We've got over a million veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan and older Americans still waiting to get benefits that they're entitled to. Was this inadequate planning? Is it something else? What's happening here?
Oh, we can't just point to one factor. Inadequate planning is definitely part of it. When George Bush, you know, well, we were attacked on 9/11, right? And we went to war in Afghanistan. And then 2 years later, we invaded Iraq. And that was a war of choice. We picked that battle. At that time, you know, the Bush administration should have thought, we are now engaged in two massive wars. People are going to get hurt. We need to hire a whole bunch of clinicians to help care for people. And we also need to hire a whole bunch of people on the disability claims processors to make sure that people get their disability benefits in a timely fashion.
And did that happen?
That did not happen.
Was it wishful thinking that we wouldn't have a lot of people that were hurt in this war, or was it denial?
I know that there were people in the VA at that time in 2004 and 2005 who were trying to get the attention of the president and encourage him to propose massive staffing increases at VA to deal with what people were predicting at that time would be a flood of people coming forward demanding services. And not just, as you mentioned, these Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, but World War II veterans needing nursing home care, Vietnam veterans who are, you know, contracting cancer at alarming rates because of Agent Orange exposure just now, right? So there's a lot of these things. And none of this was a surprise, right? And it was raised at the time. And Anthony Principi, who was the Secretary of Veterans Affairs under Bush at that time, actually resigned over this issue, the failure to staff up. But here's the big but. 2007, the Walter Reed scandal, right? The country wakes up to the fact that this is a major problem. And starting then and continuing under President Obama, we have seen massive funding increases for the VA. And yet still, despite that, the system continues to fail.
Well, that's
our
what
veterans.
I wanted to. So maybe there was inadequate preparation under President Bush's administration because they weren't expecting what happened with the war. But when President Obama came in, he vowed to fix this, to put it as a priority. And we're second term of President Obama, and it's a bigger mess than ever.
Much,
why?
Much. Much, much, much worse than when he started. And, you know, at the Center for Investigative Reporting, we've obtained all of these internal VA documents that they wouldn't share with the public and with Congress until we obtained them through a leak. And
oh, you got them through a leak, not a FOIA,
no,
not a Freedom of Information.
Filing a Freedom of Information, the whole Department of Veterans Affairs, and this is historical, it's not just under Obama, has had a real bunker mentality. And they really don't like to share anything with anyone. But with the problem getting this bad, you know, a lot of people on the inside want to do good things for vets and are upset and are now sharing important information with reporters like myself. And
so what'd you find out?
Well, we found out, I think all this was probably, like, kind of a lot of people knew about it, but you don't really see until you look at these documents that somehow, despite all the problems that we're talking about President Bush, the fact that he did not staff up, the fact that, you know, he kind of purposely ignored the casualties of these wars, that the VA continued to function kind of okay under President Bush, that the backlog of disability claims rose slightly under his presidency, but veterans continued to get their benefits in about 3 or 4 months, which at that time everyone thought was unacceptable. You know, and now, as you mentioned, under President Obama, we're up to 9 months a year. Here in Northern California, the Oakland Regional Office of the VA, the average wait time on a disability compensation benefit is over 450 days. This all happened under President Obama after we appropriated more money to solve this problem and after he said that 400,000 was unacceptable. Now we have about 1 million people waiting. So there is an extreme amount of bureaucratic dysfunction at that agency that has taken root under this president, which has having extremely negative effect for our veterans.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm joined by Aaron Glantz. He covers veteran and domestic military issues for the Center for Investigative Reporting. He spent more than 10 years covering the Iraq War and the treatment of veterans when they come home. He's the author of 3 books, most recently The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And I want to invite our listeners to join us, and particularly we're supposed to be joined by Dave Smith, who's a veteran of the Iraq War who served from 2003 to 2007. Dave has been delayed. So in the meantime, I'd like to invite people who are listening to call, and especially we'd like to hear from veterans about your experience with the transition back into civilian life, back into life in the United States, and particularly any experiences that you've had with the VA, both positive and more challenging. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. What do you think when you hear the statistic that almost 1 million veterans are still waiting for their benefits? Does hearing about the lack of services for veterans change your views about the war or about a draft? Should we have mandatory service? You can join us at 866-798-TALK. Again, it's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And I'd especially love to hear from any veterans in the audience or family members of veterans about your experience with the transition back to civilian life. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be joined by Dave Smith in just a minute. He's a veteran of the Iraq War. We're here with Aaron Glantz, who's a reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. So you were just talking about this backlog and that here in Oakland, in the Bay Area, that the backlog is even longer than the average. How does being a veteran who goes back to a rural area compare with coming back to a big urban center that might have a lot of VA centers? Like, what's the difference in terms of accessing services?
Well, again, the healthcare and the benefits side, right? In terms of accessing your benefits, like disability benefits, GI Bill, things like that, you're going to be just as screwed no matter where you live. There's a wonderful national equanimity. So somebody living in San Francisco is going to have the same weight as somebody who lives in Ukiah or Redding, you know, waiting on that same Oakland regional office. But
for their claim to be processed, not necessarily, though, for services once your claim is processed.
Yeah, I mean, then the other problem, and this is, I think, more of a historical problem. You wouldn't really blame the administration, but the VA is heavily, heavily invested in the cities in terms of providing health care. So the major hospitals in Northern California are in San Francisco at Fort Miley out by the beach, in Palo Alto near Stanford, and in Sacramento. So if you have like a traumatic brain injury, you're blown up by a roadside bomb in Iraq, or you have some kind of complicated cancer from Agent Orange, and you live in Stockton, you're going to have to go to Palo Alto to get that kind of quality healthcare service.
So that's a major commute.
And it's a big problem because it really causes people to have to choose between getting healthcare and doing other things that they might want to do in their lives. You know,
like go back to school.
Yeah, we have an excellent GI Bill right now. For example, that President Bush actually signed, he was against it at the time, was kind of shamed into signing it, that provides for all your school costs, basically. So it's quite easy to go back to school after you get out of the military, much better than, you know, previous generations. But if you are dealing with the wounds of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and you're trying to go to school, and you have medical appointments that are at like 2 o'clock on a Tuesday, and it takes you 2.5 hours to go to your medical appointment, that you have to choose between getting that health care in order to make a long-term recovery and like getting the education. And this is where the disability claims backlog would come into the mix for you, is if you could be compensated on a monthly basis, that you could afford to not go to school and not work and take care of your recovery, right? Because you'd be getting a monthly check to keep a roof over your head while you get that health care. But on the other hand, if you're not getting that check, then you have to really choose. Do I want a roof over my head? Do I want to be able to provide for my family? Or alternatively, do I want to take time, you know, to take care of these health issues that I have from the war and just pray that someday the VA will come through with this money so that I don't end up getting kicked out of my house?
And Dave Smith, that we're hoping is going to join us soon, suffered from PTSD, and he says it took a really long time for him to actually access services to deal with that. I'm just wondering if the culture around PTSD is changing in the military. I know that I've heard a lot of vets talk about this kind of culture of denial, that you should just man up and deal with it, that PTSD is for sissies. Is that still an active kind of a culture? Is that still a stigma?
Well, I think that you have 2.4 million people you mentioned who've been through these wars. So I'm always reluctant whenever anybody asks me like, oh, well, how do people feel? Well, you have 2.4 million people. They have like a lot of different experiences. So yes, there's still a stigma. Yes, people have trouble coming forward. Not everyone, but some people. What concerns me as a journalist is that even after people come forward and they want to get help, the government still makes it very difficult for them to get that help. So, for example, the VA's own inspector general found that the average wait time for a mental health evaluation was 50 days, right? So you're having difficulty sleeping, you're self-medicating with drugs or alcohol because you don't want to admit that you have a problem. Your family and friends finally get you to admit that you have this problem and you go to seek help, take a number, wait 50 days.
Right, and you're kind of at crisis point if you're
at crisis
asking.
Point. Now, they could, like, of course, you show up at the hospital, they might be able to check you in, but most of these people are not, like, at that point. They need counseling, they might need medication, and the government is not able to deliver that in a timely fashion. So this audit that I'm talking about happened a year ago, and in response to it, the Obama administration promised to hire over 1,000 new clinicians so they could speed up getting people appointments. But the VA's inspector general checked up on this, and they found that while the agency had failed to hire all the clinicians it promised, it had exceeded the number of bureaucrats that it projected to hire. And this is what I'm talking about in terms of the agency's leadership. They've identified a problem. The problem is that people are not getting mental health care at the speed at which we would like to see it. The president recognizes that it's a problem, and Congress gives them more money, right? Mm-hmm. They promise to hire more clinicians to solve this problem. They fail to hire those clinicians, but they succeed at hiring more bureaucrats.
And to do what? To oversee, ostensibly to handle these claims? Maybe
no,
process
we're talking
them
now about
quickly?
Like medical appointments, right? So the problem is that people cannot get psychiatric and psychological counseling fast enough, right? And this is the problem that you're identifying. Like, people come forward. It's really hard for them because of the stigma. People want to man up. They don't want to get help. But they finally come to the point where they want to get help. The VA does not deliver that care in a timely manner. Everyone recognizes this as a problem, and yet the VA is only able to hire more administrators to administer the program instead of hiring the psychiatrists and psychologists that veterans actually want to see to deliver the services.
And when you talk to people at the VA about why they're making these choices, what do they tell you?
They say it's really hard to find qualified psychiatrists and psychologists who are willing to work in the public sector. They say that they know that the situation is unacceptable, and don't worry, it'll be better in the future. Victory is just around the corner. But there's only so many years that you can hear this without wanting some kind of change.
And change was really promised in 2008. And the question is, why hasn't that been delivered upon? I guess I'm wondering, I don't know if you've talked to any guys, it's really hard to make that first step to ask for help in the first place. And if you're at a crisis point and somebody says, oh, yeah, come back in 50 days or we'll process this in 50 days and have an answer, what happened? I mean, do you get discouraged? Do people just drop out? We know that Dave Smith had a friend, I think somebody he had served with, who was waiting on a claim and committed suicide a week before his claim was finally processed.
Well, we at the center, we've identified that last year there were 19,500 veterans who were given disability compensation only after they were dead. So they asked for these benefits. They waited.
How many?
Almost 20,000. It paid out almost $500 million to the widows, children, and other survivors of these veterans who came home and said, I deserve these benefits. I was hurt in the war, not just Iraq, but all wars. And they strung them along, and then they died. And some of these people are strung along for decades. You know, I talked to this woman in Pennsylvania. Her husband was a World War II veteran. He was blown up twice liberating France and Belgium during World War II. His back was destroyed by the war. When he came home, he tried to gut it out, right? He didn't claim anything. He was a proud man. But in the 60s, he's like, you know what? My back is destroyed. You know, I need benefits. I can't work. And they never believed him until his death. In 2012, 40 years that his back injuries were caused by the war. And then after he died, the Board of Veterans Appeals, part of their administrative procedure, ruled that the VA had made a mistake, that he should have always been entitled to these benefits. And that was a year ago. And she, the widow, is still waiting for the check.
That's Aaron Glantz. He covers veterans and domestic military issues for the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's also the author of The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. We're talking about that transition from war back to civilian society. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after a short break.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org. You'll also find links related to today's show, and that's where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter at yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and you can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Anat Shenker Osorio, who's the author of Don't Buy It. She says that our word choices can change the debate about critical issues. Friday is our weekly media roundtable. We'll be talking with sports journalist David Zirin, and then in a special extra hour from 11 till noon, we'll speak with Robert McChesney about the changing media landscape. And Rose Aguilar will be interviewing David Zirin tomorrow night at the Mission Cultural Center in San Francisco at 7:30. You can find more information at our Facebook page. We're KALW. Today we're talking about services that are available for returning veterans. How are veterans navigating the VA system? Nearly a million vets are currently waiting for their benefit claims to be processed, and the average wait time is 273 days. It's longer here in the Bay Area. Why is this still happening? President Obama promised to revamp what he called a broken VA bureaucracy. So what's changed under his administration? And what do we owe our vets? And how can we, as members of the society, help advocate for those changes? You can join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. The number again is toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I wanted to put out a special request to veterans or families of veterans who are listening. We'd really like to hear about your own experiences. You can call us anonymously at 866-798-8255. And let's go to Mike from Santa Cruz. He's a veteran. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Welcome to your call.
Oh, great show you guys got on there. You guys are hitting a lot of really key points.
Thank you. Tell us about your experience.
Well, I served 03 to 05 with a couple of different units over that period of time. And, you know, and this goes out to a lot of veterans out there that still are serving today in public service, is that there's a lot of vets out there like myself when I got back. Some of the jobs that they want to apply for, such as law enforcement or government service or positions that require background investigations and stuff, they go through a questionnaire sometimes asking you about counseling or if you you know, seen a psychiatrist or a psychologist and stuff. And there's a fear out there with those vendors that still want to fear to serve, but at the same time don't want to be marked or don't want to affect their possibility of obtaining employment in the service of the public still.
And that's legal to ask you about counseling or any mental health issues?
Correct, it is.
And so did you experience any of that, or are you talking about friends of yours?
No, I did myself. So I put it off for quite a few years, and you know, I was having difficulty. I went through that stage when you get back, you're still at 110%, and you're going at a really fast pace, and it takes a while to slow down. But then after you go through those stages, you go through these stages of difficulty sleeping and a little bit of anxiety and stuff like that and issues like that. But you see, you still don't want to seek the help for it because you don't want to reflect negative on any type of employment, you know, that you want to do in the service for your community or like you were doing before in the military.
So what did you finally do? Did you access services?
No, I didn't. I put it off for quite a few years. And I was listening to your story about how there's a lot of soldiers out there and service members that do the same thing. And I did it for over 5 years. I put off any type of help or anything like that until I actually became employed, and then it continued to be an issue, and then I seek service.
Huh. Yeah, so stay on the line, Mike. Let's get a response from Aaron, because he's nodding his head. It sounds like he's heard this.
No, it's not uncommon. And as Mike says, you know, the kind of folks who want to go serve their country in the military are often the same kind of folks who would like to serve their community by becoming a police officer or a paramedic or a firefighter, you know, continue your service in the civilian sector. And you know, it is a perceived issue and in some cases a real issue. And it also comes down to the fact that I feel like some of the efforts of the administration to help people find work when they come home don't really match up necessarily with the expectations that people have. You know, Michelle Obama has been going around and she got this agreement from Walmart that they would hire pretty much anyone who comes home, you know, for a job to help, you know, the problem of veterans unemployment. But, you know, like Mike is coming home from Iraq. He doesn't want to be a greeter at Walmart. He wants to serve his community the same way he was doing it in uniform. And so, you know, I feel like that's an issue in terms of job placement and also in a lot of the other efforts that the government has is that they're not really listening to veterans in terms of what they want and how they can continue to help. And instead they're just thinking like, oh, what program can we put a press release out for?
What jobs are there, but does that actually match what the skill set and the things that veterans want to do? And like you say, a lot of veterans that we've spoken with say, I want to continue serving. This is what I've been trained for. So Mike, you're still on the line. You said that you served from 2003 to 2005, which is very early on in the war. And I'm just wondering if there's a difference with folks who served in the early years of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars versus now. I mean, have you noticed how things have evolved? Are things changing for the better for returning vets now?
I think the biggest issue is that it's being more, it's being put out there more, you know, with the public and the media and everything else as far as obtaining help. When I first got done, there was pretty, you're rushed out of it pretty quick, and you had made a great point about you just want to go home, see your family. You don't want to spend another month or two if you have issues that you want to report. And so they ask you a few questions, and you're just in a hurry to get out of there. And then the process is only about a day or two back then in the early parts of the war. There was no slowing down and having the opportunity to have any type of counseling and what to expect when you get out, when you see your family members and friends.
So what was it like for you, Mike? I mean, when you started noticing that you were having symptoms of PTSD, what were you noticing and what was occurring to you? Did you just feel like you were going a little nuts, or did you understand what was happening?
No, it was more of a feeling of exhaustion. Never to be able to get enough rest. You don't sleep hardly at all. A lot of guys only sleep 4 hours on average a night, a little bit of anxiety, and you get into certain units where you're on the go all the time, 24/7, day after day after day, and you still kind of get stuck in that rut, like you have to keep on going and going. So even when you're laying down trying to rest, you feel like you need to be still being doing something.
Yeah, Mike, one thing I wonder, and, you know, as somebody who's in the war myself as a reporter, also from 2003 to 2005, so the earlier part of the war, you know, I've now been back in California for 7 years. The war in Iraq is over. And I don't know, you know, as somebody who participated in this war, what does it mean to you that it's over?
Can you say it again? It broke up a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I'm just wondering. I mean, like, you served in this war, and it was like, of course, a huge thing that happened in your life and the lives of so many others. And now 7 years have passed since you were over there, almost 8 years, and the war itself is over. And do you ever think about that?
No, not really. You know, when you serve so many years and stuff, it never really is over. You still want to continue to serve, too. It's not over because you still know there's people over there serving, not so much in Iraq, but in Afghanistan and other parts of the world. So and that's probably a veteran's point of view. When you see that there's still people in harm's way, you know, serving their country, civilians might tend to be more apt to, like you were talking about, you know, their day-to-day life stuff. But veterans never forget, and they know it's never really over.
And, Mike, do you have any recommendations for what might make a transition easier or less difficult for returning vets?
Absolutely. I'm a member with the VFW and the American Legion, and the American Legion of Rioters. And I also work, I went to a vet center here in San Jose. It's called the Vet Center on 2nd Street. Surround yourself by people that know what you're going through, and don't be afraid to talk to them. You know, get with an organization like ALR or VFW. Go to the vet center, go to the VA, and then start your process as soon as possible. And when you surround people that are been out for a little bit, they have a little bit of understanding, and it helps. It helps to talk and get some of those things off your chest.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us, Mike, and we wish you the best of luck. That was Mike from Santa Cruz. You're listening to Your Call. We're talking about reintegration into civilian life for veterans, particularly combat veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're talking about how the VA system works. Aaron Glantz is a staff reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's done a lot of reporting on veterans and the war. He's the author of The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And if you'd like to join our conversation here on Your Call, we're at 866-798-TALK. Again, that number is 866-798-8255. We'd especially like to hear from veterans or family members of veterans about their experiences with coming home from war. Again, that number toll-free is 866-798-8255. And let's go to Alan. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I just happened to pass and hear your show. And it's interesting because I've been on both sides, and I'm currently an employee of the VA in Palo Alto.
And you're also a vet? And you're also a veteran?
Yes, and I'm a disabled vet also. So I've been through the issue of waiting on my benefits. I've also I've also benefited from the educational benefits because I went on to from a homeless vet. To have some services in Menlo Park and in Palo Alto, which have been outstanding for me. Now, I agree with the gentleman on some issues, but some issues I don't. There are a lot of wonderful people at the VA. And me being an employee at the VA, I was hired because I was a disabled vet. Some services have been cut since I have went through the system as a patient. But they are constantly plugging in with other systems. Like they're developing a bunch of groups at the VA, the outreach center here in Redwood City. But my point is that what I'm dealing with now and what I see as an employee is that they are not hiring enough vets to fill the void. There are too many non-vets getting jobs that vets should have, especially in the Veterans Department of Veterans Administration. The reason why I say that is because I noticed that there's a lot of nepotism, and I don't think that has anything to do with the administration. I think that has to do with what the gentleman, what I totally agree with the gentleman, is that there's a lot of bureaucrats there, and there are people there who really shouldn't be there. That's my observation of being an employee there.
And Alan, so, what's the culture like? I mean, do you all discuss these backlogs and how to deal with it? What kinds of conversations are you having inside of the VA? And Aaron, well, I know it looks like you have a question too, so go ahead and answer that, and then we'll get to Aaron.
Well, I'm an employee, and I work in within the hospital. But as an employee, other veterans, what we see is that, sure, the educational benefits are helping those veterans who want to excel and progress and help themselves, okay? But when I graduated from the University of San Francisco. They're not paying me what they should pay me. So you have a point where they give you a job, but you don't get what you deserve, and you can't really live off that in this area. So, you know, those are some of the things that, It's kind of disheartening when you see other people who have not served and they have jobs which you long to get or you try to get, and it's very difficult.
Hold on for 1 second, Alan. I wanted to stay on the line. I wanted to ask both you and Aaron about this because it's something that we've heard from a lot of vets, this fear that, okay, so now we're talking about PTSD much more in the open, about mental illness issues as something legitimate and not to be ashamed of. And yet people talk about going in for jobs and being questioned about, have you had, you know, experiences in combat that might reflect upon your job experience now. So it seems to be almost a double-edged sword.
I think think what Alan is talking about is actually another very important issue, which is the fact that these VA programs are often excellent, and especially here in the Bay Area. You know, the San Francisco VA is affiliated with UCSF. The Palo Alto VA is affiliated with Stanford. You have some of the best doctors in the whole world at treating combat trauma and combat physical injuries in the world at these two VA hospitals, and some of the nationally recognized homeless veterans programs, drug rehab programs right here in the Bay Area. You know, the Homeless Veterans Rehabilitation Program, HVRP, in Palo Alto is model for the whole country, right? But now you're a veteran. You're trying to access this care. The VA has created a whole level of bureaucracy that keeps people from getting there, right?
Is there Instead a legitimate of, reason for that, though?
I think
is there
what
a fear
we
of
have,
fraudulent claims?
Well, there's two issues. There's the claims bureaucracy, which we can talk about. But now here we're on the healthcare side, right? The problem is rationing, right? If every veteran were to suddenly come up tomorrow and say, "I need healthcare," VA couldn't do it, right? So rather than going to the president and saying, like, "Hey, we have to hire like an you know a tremendous number of new clinicians," they insulate themselves with this level of bureaucracy, right? And so Alan is exactly right. He works with a lot of great people there. And then he also works with a lot of administrators whose whole job appears to be keeping people away from those great people. And I think that that's where we as the wider public and members of Congress and so forth, I mean, we need to be very mindful of both of these factors. The horrible bureaucracy that is failing veterans, which coexists right alongside with some of the best care anywhere.
So how do you cut through that and get to this best care? Go ahead, Alan.
I'm sorry. My point is, too, I think that, you know, there's no reason right now for veterans who suffer from PTSD. There's no reason for veterans who have they have a wonderful polytrauma center out there, and they're great people help veterans that are coming back. But there's no reason for veterans right now to not be able to put themselves in a position to better themselves. But my point that I wanted to put an exclamation point on is that when you do that, and you've gone through all that hard work, when you've got all your medical issues under control and you finally got a direction in your life and you've accomplished the goal of putting yourself through school, compliments of the government, or you've been in a position where you went through an excellent program that helped you get your life on track, now you want a job. And the administration did say, "Hey, look, we want veterans to work." President Obama did say, "I want veterans to be hired just like that." So that is what I see that is not happening fast enough at the VA. And I see people who should not be at the VA being hired. And it's because I agree with Aaron, because of the bureaucratic issue that is totally out of control. You have six people. For instance, me and an individual worked and did a job. We did this job while we are two veterans who put ourselves through, we straighten out our lives, we have a job, and we're going through the system. But they bring another person in who has not been a vet, and they call it an internship program, and they give that individual the job. So that's my point. You have two veterans who have done the job flawlessly, two veterans, which would be cheaper for the government, and they bring a person in who is an intern, and that individual gets the job, and they totally just disregard us veterans. And that's the voice that I want. That's what I want to put out there, and I hope someone out there hears that someone will start investigating, well, why is this happening? Why are veterans being stepped over?
For jobs. You know. Well, thank you so much for calling. We really appreciate hearing from you, Alan. We've got more callers that I'd like to get to, so thank you so much. Let's go to Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger. Welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you. I'd just like to say a few things. First of all, if you feel yourself ill, get help. Mental illness is the same thing essentially as a physical illness. I'm sorry, are we still on?
Yeah, you're still there. Go ahead. Don't be ashamed.
Just simply don't be ashamed. The second thing is, I belong to an organization called the Marine Corps League. They meet the third Saturday of every month in San Bruno. You can get there. If you go on the website, you can find the address. It's at the American Legion Hall there. It's at 11 a.m. in the morning. A lot of Marines are there. It's a good way to meet other Marines and discuss your what you've experienced. The third thing, this is for your guest.
Yeah.
I went through the Marines a long time ago, long before we had any of those wars. It was in 1956 I joined. I was 16 years old. The training was severe, very hard. If you weren't, you had to be strong to endure that. And my question to your guest is, is there a percentage the same for the Army veterans as they are for the Marines? Do Marines suffer at the same level as Army veterans?
Well, Roger, because we're running out of time, let me get a response from Aaron about PTSD in Marines versus Army.
No, I think that Roger's point is actually well taken, that if you look over the course of this 10 years of war, the highest, you know, two parts of our military, the Army and the Marine Corps, have been fighting these wars, and the Navy and the Air Force have mostly been on the sidelines. And the suicide rate amongst Army active duty has risen steadily over the course of these wars. It's now at record levels. With the Marines, they've also been fighting the same level of intensity, but the Marine Corps seems to be doing something well that the Army is not doing in terms of serving people, preparing people, and caring for them when they come home, and providing that sense of teamwork and camaraderie after they get back. And so we do not see the same suicide rate amongst active duty Marines that we do in the Army, and I think that does deserve considerable attention and research about why that is.
And let's go to Bob from Inverness. Welcome to your call. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that at the San Francisco VA hospital, I've never had such good treatment. But qualifying took about 4 or 5 years. And the disabled, I'd given up through the VA system. The Disabled American Veterans did it for me. And once you're in, it's like a fine restaurant in New York where you're separated by a big red velvet rope. Once you're in, it's really good. But to get in, it's very, very hard.
And that's what we keep hearing, Bob, is that, yeah, we have the greatest care that you can even imagine, but the access, and you said, what, 4 to 5 years it took?
Well, I went in after Vietnam era. I was at Columbia, and I applied through New York. And what I mostly got was a day through there just about combing through my pubic hairs and giving me a subway token back to the Upper West Side. I gave it up, reapplied here. I met the brick wall, and finally another guy I knew from who was an ex-paratrooper, said, I'm getting it. Go through Disabled American Vets. And those guys really got it within a couple of years. But you shouldn't have to do all of that. The records were pretty clear. I was injured, and it was pretty well documented a lot of times. When you're a paratrooper and a ranger, you do that. And I'm seeing a lot of young kids here, young compared to me, who are out of this recent war here in Point Reyes, who really need the treatment and who are walking wounded, and you know they're going to explode. It's a scandal.
I do want to say one thing which is very important about this point. You know, traditionally, you've had to go through this claims process and get your claim approved by this disability claims bureaucracy, which is completely broken, in order to get into the healthcare side. And it has been traditionally exactly the way the caller describes, of kind of like this, you know, this velvet curtain that you got to pull back to get in and get the quality care. Congress recognized this was a problem, and a few years ago they passed a new law that said that in the 5 years that you come back from the war, you get free health care regardless of your claim status. So if you're just coming back for Iraq and Afghanistan within the last 5 years, you can go to the VA for anything and they have to treat you.
Then why is there this backlog?
Well, first of all, you have a lot of people like the caller who served in Vietnam, and this does not apply to them. They still have to fight that fight. Or even we've been at war in Iraq and Afghanistan for 10 years now, right? More than 10 years. So all the people like, you know, the caller earlier, Mike in Santa Cruz, got out in 2005. We're well past 5 years now. He has got to fight that fight if he wants to go to the VA. So,
yeah, and a lot of the people that we're hearing from, that took them 5 years to say, okay, this is a problem.
Yeah, it's an issue, but I just want to make this one point, because if there are people out there in the listening audience who have got out of the military within the last 5 years, you go to the VA right now, they have to take you for health care.
So you can go right now. All right. Well, so we're winding up the show. We just have a couple of minutes left. Something that we keep hearing is that the top concerns seem to be accessing jobs and accessing care without having a stigma that's going to affect your career choices. So what changes would you advocate that the VA could make, kind of rational, reasonable changes that you would say the VA could be making?
You know, I think the frustrating thing is that Congress and the president have really made a lot of these right things. They've done the right things, right? And the VA itself just needs to get its act together bureaucratically. Right. They have this claim system that forces people to wait years. They need to find a way to streamline it. It's not rocket science. Right. You were a ranger in the war. You parachuted all the time. You say your knee is blown out because of all these parachute accidents that you were involved in. There's documentation. Just give this person their benefits. Right. And so it's not a political problem. It's an operational problem and it's a management problem. And so it needs attention from the president and from other high-ranking officials in Washington all the way down to the administrators of our hospitals and benefits offices here in the Bay Area to really look in detail. It's not like exciting, right? But like these boring bureaucratic issues have huge impacts on real people's lives when they try to reintegrate into civilian life.
Well, and what about digitizing the records? Is that, you talked about these hundreds of thousands of claims that are in paper form.
Yeah, they're working on it. They're working on it. They've been working on it for 5 years, right? So
that seems incomprehensible to me.
Yeah, so that's why I'm saying it's a management issue. Who's in charge here? Are they doing a good job? If they can, their job can be improved, how can their job be improved? If they're incompetent people, who else can do it better?
All right,
right?
So
these are the questions that we should be asking.
Final 15 seconds. How about what can we as non-military civilians do to advocate for veterans?
You know, I think that a show like this is the most important thing. Other ways that you can keep this issue alive in your community so it doesn't get kicked to the curb, you know, like it did after 1975 when the Vietnam War ended. We have to keep this conversation going.
Even once the wars have wound down.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there, but we commit to doing more conversations about this. I want to thank Aaron Glantz, who's a staff reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's also the author of The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against Americans Veterans. And we'll have links to all of that information at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How might progressives redefine a winning message? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Anat Shenker Osorio, author of Don't Buy It, The Trouble with Talking Nonsense. She explores how wrong-headed metaphors and deceptive language have muddled our thinking on everything from the economy and the environment to abortion and immigration. She argues that a better word choice alone can win the debate. If you're active in getting your message out, what actually works? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.